Do whales sneeze?
I'm not sure, but luckily I've got an amazing whale expert I can call on.
We essentially go out onto a boat, we go out to the sea, we look for whales, we see a whale breathing.
Who will take us through her experiments.
And then as the whale takes a breath, the drone is flown through the snot and will deliberately collect as much snot as possible.
And let us know the answer. How does that sound, Guy?
That would be fun.
Join us on The Conversation's Curious Kids, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB Digital Radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Right, time to explore the universe. Welcome along. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for giving us a listen. My name's Dan, and this week, in the only show that takes you to the far reaches of the galaxy and then brings you back in about 30 minutes so no one notices that you're gone, we're chatting about humanity's mission to get closer to the sun than ever before. Also, we'll learn about the most dangerous tree in the world. It makes a fruit that the Spanish call the little apple of death. And we'll talk to a scientist about the secret life of one of the planet's rarest antelopes. That's on the way. Also, I've got some of your questions to run through in just a sec. First, let's catch up with one of our favourite geniuses on the Fun Kids Science Weekly. It's Professor Hallux, and this week, he's looking into your mouth.
Professor Hallux's Digital Dental Depository, with support from Philips Sonicare. To honour great Uncle Halitosis, dentist extraordinaire, on the occasion of his 100th birthday, Professor Hallux is creating a pop-up digital dental depository, an oral health help desk. He's going to see how many questions all about teeth he can answer against the clock.
Right, Nurse Nanobot. Today we've got some particularly pongy posers, all about bad breath. Did you know that's what halitosis means? Great Uncle Halitosis never found it funny for some reason.
Okay, let's start. How can you tell if you've got bad breath?
Well, there are some pretty obvious signs. Like if people start to move away from you when you talk or hold their nose. If you've got a close friend, you could always ask them to be honest. There's a simple test you can do. Lick the back of your hand and take a sniff. If the smell is bad, you can be fairly sure your breath is bad too.
A strong start, Professor. Next question. What causes bad breath?
The most common cause is the smelly gases released by bacteria as they multiply on your teeth, gums and tongue. Particles of food can get caught between your teeth and also start to whiff as they decompose. And strong food like coffee, onions and garlic can also make your breath stinky too.
Next question. Does it matter if you've got bad breath?
Well, it depends how many friends you want. Seriously, bacteria on teeth and gums causes decay and toothache and can result in teeth needing to be removed. One of the warning signs of bacteria in decay is that you always have bad breath or a bad taste in your mouth. So yes, it does matter if you've got bad breath.
You're doing great, Prof. Keep it up. How can you prevent bad breath?
Well, that's simple. To prevent bad breath, keep your breath fresh. And to keep your breath fresh, clean your teeth twice a day, after breakfast and after supper before you go to bed. You need to make sure that you do a thorough job and get into every nook and cranny. And don't forget to clean your tongue as well. You could use a special tongue brush to help. Don't forget flossing too, either with interdental brushes, although make sure they're the right size, or using the latest technology like an air flosser, puffing air and water through the gaps that brushes can't easily reach. And finish with an antibacterial mouthwash.
Coming up to the finish now. So, what if you can't seem to shift the whiff?
It can be helpful to keep a diary of what you've been eating. That way you may be able to identify any food or drinks which make things worse. If you really can't seem to get rid of bad breath, it's very important you visit your dentist as it might be a sign of an underlying problem. Your dentist will be the best person to solve the puzzle of the pong. Seeing your dentist every 6 months is ideal. And don't forget to see a hygienist once a year. They're the ones that ensure all the nasty bacteria and plaque is removed from your teeth. This will ensure you have the freshest smelling breath, healthiest and whitest shining teeth around.
That's correct, and time's up. Brilliant, Professor. Very respectable score there, and lots of data for the digital dental depository.
Professor Hallux's digital dental depository, with support from Philips Sonicare. Find out more at funkidslive.com/Hallux.
So in the last few weeks, the reviews for the Fun Kids Science Weekly on the iTunes podcast store, they've gone absolutely berserk. I've got so many questions coming in over there. Because, you know, right, if you've got something sciencey that you want to ask an expert, the best place to tell me is over on the iTunes podcast store, and then I will find the perfect person to explain it for you. This is from James Kendall, who is 5. Hello, James. Who asks, why do leaves change colour in the autumn? James, it's all to do... I can answer this one for you. I don't need an expert. It's all to do with the chlorophyll, which is in the leaf, and it gives them their colour. You know, the really bright, vibrant colours that you see during the spring and in the summer. Well, that chlorophyll, it breaks down. And it breaks down during the autumn because as the length of sunlight goes down, as the days get shorter and the temperature gets colder, it's harder for them to make the chlorophyll anymore. Thank you so much, James. That's answered for you. Also, a question from William in Birmingham, who wants to know why the planets revolve around the sun. It's all to do with gravity, William, and which huge mass has stronger gravity. I know it's about that, but I will try and get a proper space expert on the show to explain it in greater detail for you, William, in the next few weeks. And also something from Lucy, who is 7, who asks why pug dogs can't breathe anymore. Well, Lucy, it's because pugs, they've been selectively bred to look the cutest. People like them with their short, stubby noses. And because pugs are really popular dogs right now, they make them look even cuter with even shorter noses. It's actually, they've not always been like that. It's really interesting. When you're next online, search for like Victorian pug dogs, because they used to have really long noses, almost snouts, almost like something you'd see on a horse. But now they've been bred to be really short. That's it for you, Lucy. Thank you so much for getting in touch. Remember, if you've got a sciencey question that you want to ask an expert, let me know first by leaving the Fun Kids Science Weekly a review on the iTunes podcast store. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, a few weeks ago on the show, we spoke about the news that the world's largest forest antelope has been caught on camera in Uganda for the first time. And I read this and I wanted to know more. I wanted to know what they are, what they do, what they eat, why are they so secret? Well, who is this elusive striped antelope, the lowland bongo? And now Stuart Nixon is from Chester Zoo. He carried out the study alongside the Uganda Wildlife Authority, and he's on the phone. Hey, Stuart.
Hi, how are you doing?
Yeah, very well. Thanks so much for joining us. So what prompted you to try and find out more about this elusive striped antelope?
Well, we were working in Uganda anyway, and we'd heard kind of repeated rumours that a large stripy animal had been seen in the Semliki Forest, which is where we carried out the research. And with that being so close to the Congo border, it's actually on the border, where Bongo and another large stripy mammal, the Okapi, live, we decided that we would take a look and we put some camera traps out and see whether we could get to the bottom of the rumours. And after 3 months of leaving these cameras out, we did in fact get the bongo on camera trap. So quite a remarkable discovery, really.
So I've said that it's elusive, but maybe we should build more on that. Aside from the 3 months that it took you to figure out that these things are wandering around, how regularly do we have sightings of them and we've recorded them being in action?
Okay, so they're actually a very shy species. It's very rare that people actually see them in the forest. Also, sometimes the tracks are quite hard to identify in the forest because they can be confused with other species as well. So it's a shy species. It doesn't occur in particularly high numbers anywhere, and they're very good at keeping out the way of people. It's quite a difficult species to see. There's probably very few people who've seen them in the wild, alive as it were. So very, very good at hiding such a big animal.
So what do we know about them? What do we know about the lowland bongo? How do they work? What do they eat? What do they look like? Who are their main predators?
Okay, so the bongo is It's the largest forest antelope. It's probably around three and a half feet tall at its shoulder, and then its head is much higher. And it's got these two amazing big spiraling horns. It's a beautiful kind of chestnut red colour with white stripes which go down the side of its body, which would probably help it stay camouflaged in the forest. They are herbivorous. That means just eat plants, leaves, some kind of almost like herby plants which grow on the floor, occasional bits of fruit, that kind of thing. They quite like forest clearings, actually, where you get lots of light coming in, which makes the plants grow, and then the bongo can graze there quite well. They're primarily solitary, or they live in kind of loose groups, but they're certainly not a very social animal that lives in big herds or anything like that.
And where do they rank, do you think, on the list of creatures that like to keep themselves secret? Are they up there on the top? Is there some beasts above them that are hardly ever seen?
They're quite far up there for an African species, yeah. I mean, there are other species which are also very difficult to see, such as the okapi that I mentioned, and other cryptic species which probably come out at night more, like pangolins, and even big cats sometimes, like leopards. But they're definitely an elusive species. I mean, I've been working in Central African rainforest for 18 years, and I've actually physically seen one once in an area where there were quite a lot of them, and that was in a different part of Central Africa.
And when you know that they're there, when you've heard rumours that there are these bongos roaming around, I mean, I know you said it's quite simply, you stuck a camera there, but did you do that with any intelligence of where you should put the camera, what you should do to try and coax them towards it?
Well, no, not really. We come up with a design, and we actually put 40 cameras out, sort of equally spaced in the forest, and then we put them near trails or areas where we think animals might pass, and then it's just a waiting game. If you can imagine, each camera is like a person stood permanently awake in that spot, and you're just waiting for an animal to walk past. So it's a game of luck in one way. But if the cameras are out long enough and you've got enough of them, you should pick any species which are present up on it.
And now you've got a keener understanding, because you've seen them, of where they are. Are scientists trying to help them out at all? Or is it just, well, they've survived so far on their own, we'll leave them be?
No, we start with the next steps now, which is primarily the Wildlife Authority in Uganda. They know that this species is present. So we've trained their park rangers who protect the forest in how to spot bongo sign and to record where they see their dung and their tracks, and if they actually see them in the forest. And then we plan in the future to put some more camera traps out in the forest and just monitor them and see if we can find out any more about where they are. And we may actually be able at some point in the future to count them, because each animal's got its individual stripes. So if we can get enough photographs from camera traps, we might be able to start to work out actually how many that there are.
Stuart, how well do you know your poisonous animals?
Not bad. You could try me.
Right, well, we get questions from listeners sent in all the time through the iTunes podcast store. And this is from Ted, who is 6. And he wants to know whether poisonous animals, like venomous snakes, we talk about them a lot on the show, can they get poisoned by other poisonous animals?
Yes, they can. So, a venomous snake could quite easily be killed by another venomous snake. Or I guess another one to consider would be large tarantulas in kind of Central and South America can be attacked by a venomous wasp, which will then lay its eggs in the tarantula. It's quite a ghastly thing, really. But yes, certainly venomous animals can be poisoned by other venomous animals.
And how many creatures in the jungle have developed and evolved a natural antidote and that they are unpoisonable? I'm not after a number, I'm just curious.
I could give you some examples. There is a really cool animal called a honey badger, which we do find in the African forest, but it also lives in the grasslands, which is a very tough animal, and it will raid bees' nests, and it will also eat snakes. And that the honey badger can catch a cobra, for example, and probably, you know, withstand 10, 12 bites feel a bit dopey for a few minutes, then we'll get back up and then we'll eat the cobra. So there are animals out there which have definitely developed a resistance to these venoms from other creatures.
Fantastic. Well, I mean, not something you want to say in front of someone who loves animals so much, but we managed to kill two birds with one stone there, Stuart. Thank you so much for answering the question and telling us loads more about the lowland bongo. Thanks for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly.
No problem. Thank you very much.
Right, time for this week's Dangerous Dan, where we look at the most mean and evil things in the universe. And today, we're headed to the United States to look at the most dangerous tree in the world. You'll find the manganeal tree across Florida and along the Caribbean coast. They grow up to around 12 metres high. They've got a 12-foot thick trunk, and just about every single part of the manganeal is designed to hurt you. Have a listen. The sap that's produced by the tree, it contains a really powerful irritant like a poison, and just brushing past it will leave you with a scalded, burnt patch of skin. You can't even shelter underneath it during like a tropical storm, which they have quite a lot of over there, because the water dilutes the sap and it runs down, but you'll still come out in rashes. And you can't even burn the trees down either, because the smoke that makes causes breathing problems. It can even turn you blind. It's the fruit, though, that it makes when things get really deadly. The manganeal tree, it produces an apple, and the Spanish, they've got a name for this apple. They call it the little apple of death. Taking a bite of it will make you sick out of both ends for ages, and it'll dehydrate your body to the point of death. Now, the manganeal tree, it's so dangerous that in many places where you find them, they'll be painted with a red cross against the bark that they used to do when the plague was breaking out way back hundreds of years ago, and it's a warning to stay well away. Let's travel all around the UK with Bex from the Club on Fun Kids and me. We're finding out about trains of the future in our brilliant Britain's Digital Railway series.
Britain's Digital Railway.
Stations are where passengers begin their journey. Whether that journey is on a train, tram or tube, they're a really important part of the rail network. And with over 3,000 of them across Britain, they really do come in all shapes and sizes. Some are fairly small and may just have one platform, whilst others, often in cities or places where passengers make connections to other parts of the country, have many platforms, connected by footbridges or underpasses. Sometimes these stations might also be underground. Bex and Dan find out more.
Only three more stops, Bex. Nearly there.
It feels like we've stopped at 1,000 stations already. But it is funny how they're all kind of different.
Oh, man, there's a snack shop with cake. I'm starving. Do you think we've got time for a quick slice?
I doubt it. Looks nice though.
Many things you'll see at stations are there to help your journey. Ticket offices or machines to buy tickets, timetables to help plan journeys, and departure boards and station staff to tell you when trains are leaving and from which platform. Through speakers, you'll also hear messages to keep people up to date and information to keep people safe. There's something all stations have. Platforms. You can't get on a train without them. To help passengers get on and off the train, tube or tram, it's best when platforms are of a certain height, generally the same height as the doors. Really old platforms might vary in height and not suit modern rail vehicles. In London, deep tube trains are much smaller and lower than overground trains, something that's very obvious when they share the same platform. A way of keeping passengers safe is by making sure the gap between the train and the platform is as small as possible. Otherwise, people might fall onto the track when getting on or off. It's best if platforms are straight, so that the staff can see the whole train when preparing to close the doors. But sometimes, that's not always possible. Some of London's underground tube lines were built to follow the route of the roads above, and are sometimes very twisty. And as modern tube carriages are longer compared to their Victorian counterparts, at some stations, you might need to
mind the gap.
You should always stay behind the yellow line on the platform. Trains can pass at speed, and you don't want to get caught in the draft.
Oh, but why are they called platforms? Because I thought platforms were things that were kind of high up. They don't seem very high.
Well, most platforms are higher than the track. If they weren't raised, you need a stepladder to get onto the train, like in some parts of Europe.
Oh, looks like we're on the move.
Hey, look! There's another kind of station. It's a freight depot.
As well as passengers, the railways carry freight around the country, taking heavy traffic off the roads, which is good for the environment. Freight trains need their own type of station, where goods are loaded from lorries and ships onto trains, from train to train, and from trains onto lorries. Sometimes you find them near to passenger stations, although larger freight depots might be separate and near to ports or motorway junctions. Today, freight is generally either carried in containers or in special wagons to carry materials such as coal, metals, oil and aggregates.
That's cool. It's good to know that railways are helping take lorries off the roads.
Yeah. Although I don't think you get a slice of cake as easily at a freight station.
Britain's Digital Railway, with support from the Royal Academy of Engineering. Find out more at funkidslive.com/railway.
Right, time to talk about all the science that has been in the news this week. The Parker Solar Probe, which was launched by America, it broke the record for getting closest to the sun last week. It passed the previous record of being within 43 million kilometres of the sun, which was set in 1976, and it will get to just 6.12 million kilometres away by the end of the mission. It will be exposed to temperatures of around 1,300 degrees Celsius. Parker, scientists hope, will help us understand better how the sun works and all of the solar winds and the storms that it makes. Also staying in space, a British-led mission to clear up space junk has started its second experiment. The Remove Debris satellite ejected a small object last week and it tracked it using laser beams, which will help it understand how space junk and rubbish really works and floats. And finally, it looks like hydrogen trains may be the future of travel because they're currently being made in the UK to reach areas that current trains can't go. And they're hoped to replace polluting diesel trains. All the hydrogen ones make, once they've had their journey, is water, which is brilliant, because we always need more water. That is the end for this week's Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for giving us a listen. Remember, if you've got a sciencey question that you want answered by a proper expert, you need to let me know first, and then I will do the digging to find the right person to answer it for you. You can tell me as a review over on the iTunes podcast store. Open that up, search for the Fun Kids Science Weekly, type, give us 5 stars, leave your name so I can give you a shout out in the next few weeks. Drop your question in the comment box at the bottom and I will find someone to answer it for you. Also, while you're on iTunes, you can find all of the brilliant Fun Kids Science series. They're all free for you to download on there. We've also got it on the free Fun Kids app, and you can have a listen at funkidslive.com. And Fun Kids is the UK's biggest children's radio station, which you can listen to all over the country. You can find it on that free Fun Kids app, on your DAB digital radio, and over at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Do whales sneeze?
I'm not sure, but luckily I've got an amazing whale expert I can call on.
We essentially go out onto a boat, we go out to the sea, we look for whales, we see a whale breathing.
Who will take us through her experiments.
And then as the whale takes a breath, the drone is flown through the snot, and will deliberately collect as much snot as possible.
And let us know the answer. How does that sound, Guy?
That would be fun.
Join us on the Conversations Curious Kids, wherever you get your podcasts.